That's been my experience anyway.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody. We'll be starting again in about 2 minutes.
We've never stopped.
I know.
Yeah, I would just like to add before we go back onto the next sessions that the first three were really so enlightening, and I'm so glad that we are all able to participate from many corners of the North American continent.
What continent? Where are you?
I'm in Denver, Colorado.
Oh, wow.
Very nice.
But I've visited the Philadelphia Lodge when there was a conference there a few years ago. So very grateful that I had that opportunity.
I think our furthest visitor today is actually from Sweden.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. So it's just where is the continent, North America.
Hey, Eva.
Hey, hi, Sweden.
Peter here.
I'm Lisa.
Hi. Hi, nice to see you. We have a student in our London, Ontario Lodge from Holland.
Oh.
Yeah, nice to see you, Eva. And who's the gentleman beside you, Eva?
Peter?
Peter here. Yeah.
And then we have Annelies.
Hi.
Oh, three of you. Lovely. Four. Oh my goodness.
And Sheftin.
Hi.
How are you? Oh, hello, everyone. Hi. Sweden. Nice to see you.
Hello. Greetings.
Yes.
So, as I've been corrected, we are not starting or restarting, but we are continuing, just changing our focus.
Hello.
And our next presenter is a student and associate from the United Lodge of Theosophists in Washington, D.C. And as said, in these last three sessions, we're going to look at some of the more particular aspects of meditation, whether we're carrying it out on a lifetime basis or a definite time of practice. So our first presenter is going to give us a talk on concentration and meditation.
I'm going to read the definition of mind from the Sacred Doctrine first, since no one else did. And we're dealing with the mind. Mind is a name given to the sum of the states of consciousness grouped under thought, will, and feeling. And I don't remember anyone talking about mind, except I think Judy, the previous speaker, referred to it as the monkey mind. In Theosophy, we are very aware that the mind works in two different ways, and I'm going to bring that to the forward, the monkey mind being the intellectual mind that causes tremendous difficulty during meditation and concentration, and the other one is the one that is referred to as the higher mind, which is what we are trying to reach, because we need it to come to our aid so that we can transcend. Now, having said that, this portion of the talk is practical. And Rajyoga does not really require any specified postures. It does not encourage any of that, but it brings to the forefront that we're actually dealing with the inner man, and whose sphere is the world of thought. And that's why that statement was made. So when we place the highest ideal before ourselves and strive incessantly to rise up to it, this constitutes the true concentration, which is recognized in this philosophy. Because we're dealing with the inner world of noumena and not the outer shell, which is the phenomena. Now, Mr. Judge has practical solutions or applications that we need to be aware of before we start our meditation. One of them, he says, we need to first decide what actions are to be performed and which ones are not. In other words, whatever comes to us is not to be addressed indiscriminately, that we have to discover what to do and perform only those that is our duty to do so. He says also, when we make this discrimination between what to do and what not to do, we have to also detach ourselves from the end result, because sometimes we know what is going to happen as a result of what we have decided to do, but still that detachment has to be there. And he says a lot of students fail in meditation because they're attached to the end result of these actions. So he is saying that with this watching of our thoughts and actions, eventually will bring us to the performance of that true concentration, which increases the power of meditation. And he reminds us that it is not meditation to sit in a room and stare at a spot, or have a mind which is wandering. These are not meditative processes, he reminds us. Now, in one of his letters, I believe it's number 5 in letters that have helped me, he also reminds us that when we sit to meditation, the first thing we need to do is remind ourselves that we are not the body, we're not the astral body, we're not the passions and desires, and we are not the intellectual lower mind, which was called the mind before. So then, what is it necessary that we should do besides deciding what actions to take and which ones not to do? In 5 years of theosophy, this suggestion is made, that the first requisite is a thorough purity of the heart. And as we know, the heart is extremely important in also exercising the paramitas. So Zoroaster's philosophy is based on Ashoy, which is purity. So purity of thought, purity of word, and purity of deed, these are the essentials if we are actually going to reach up to the God within us, because that Christ principle that is in the heart is who we truly are. None other than that are we. The art that is designating that power in our own heart. So then this cultivation of the feeling of unselfish philanthropy is the path that we have to traverse. In the Voice of the Silence, it is also stated that the first paramita is dana, which is love and charity. And this is the starting point of this path. It is necessary for meditation also. Through the cultivation of this philanthropy, which the previous speaker also talked that she only knows how to attune herself to others when she's actually helping others. And this alone, it says, will lead us to universal love, and the realization of it constitutes the progress, which then removes the chains of Maya, which is around the ego. So through this process, eventually then, we cease to consider our personal feelings, our blood types, our friendships, our patriotism, our race predilection. All these, as a result of this philanthropic effort, eventually get blended into one universal feeling, which is the only true and the holy unselfish one. And this then, according to the venerated Mahatma, is an immense love for humanity as a whole. So when we are sitting for meditation, it is extremely important and necessary to remember that we are part of the whole, we are not the whole, we are part of the whole. All the other souls are in that too. We're not just on our own segregated, but we are blended with the rest. So in this process then, we are considering joining that inner light. Reasoning from the known, we are then going towards the unknown. The known is our phenomenal world. But with our five senses, we cognize all that is around us, which is a necessary step in development. But all that is manifested in our universe is the effect. The causes then are behind it, and these are the noumenal. They are the unmanifested, and they represent the unknown world. So in order to accomplish this then, this continued attention to the subject is recommended. And for that, it is stated that not only do we need the deductive method, but also the inductive method. Now, the deductive is going from generals to the particulars, and the secret doctrine and the three fundamental propositions just does that for us. So we can start one fundamental or whatever that speaks to the heart, but it has to be a deductive one, a general one. And for this student, that general one is unity, because as you remember, the first object of the theosophical movement of theosophical society was constituting a universal nucleus of brotherhood. She just wanted to constitute the nucleus. So if we put that in our own heart, that we are part of the whole, but we are united, and that becomes an essential part of that meditative process, in time, we come to realization of it. And then we have to take that general deductive method, the propositions of, or the axioms that we accept as being the true ones, and then use the inductive method, which is going from particulars to the generals, and see if that methodology supports the general axioms that we had started with. This student read a whole bunch of stuff for this preparation, but there is a particular article in Elixir of Life, which is entitled Elixir of Life, and it is important for each one of us to read that for ourselves. Also, since we're dealing with the inner man, we need to understand what the astral body or the astral man does, because it's the link between the animal physical and the other one. Mr. Judge, in his Culture of Cultivation, tells us what vanity, fear, jealousy, anger does to that body. And I think you all need to read that article for yourselves to see what the effect is, so that it can be removed. So first then, this study is intellectual. We need to understand the axioms from general to particular and particular to general in an intellectual way. And we need to grasp it. And because as the first speaker said, meditative process can be divided into two. One is meditation taken as a daily or intermittent process, that we go somewhere to meditate and try to bring the highest ideal before us for that meditative process. But the second one referred to in that talk was the concentration of each life from a very young age to an old age on the heart's desire. In other words, there is something in each of us that we want to achieve, and that is for all peoples, whether we are a philosopher, mystic, saint, criminal, an artist, there is that which is pursued, which has it which has its seat in the heart, and it never really lets go of us. And we are continuously coming back to it, whatever it is that we have in our heart. But Mr. Judge tells us that if our goal is fixed down near the ground, the results will be strong, very lasting, but related to the love level which we have set our ideal on. And he says that this process not only is for this lifetime, as we talked about meditation going from life to life, it will continue on in the next and the next. So it carries it with it to the next rebirth. So then what is it that we need to do in this contemplation? It will show that the noumenal has to be understood, as we said, intellectually. But in order to do that, we have to identify ourselves with nature. And HPV has tremendous articles on that, where we, and the previous speaker touched on it a little bit, that we truly are part of all of the kingdoms below us, as well as those above us. The ones below us look at the human kingdom for guidance, and we need to be aware of what we are doing in influencing those lives, whether it is elemental, plant, or animal life, and how our attitude is fixed towards those kingdoms. The ones that above us are the ones that guide us, because our higher aspirations are realized by that lodge, by that brotherhood who assists every sincere student of theosophy in their endeavor to realize that one reality, which is the self. But that self is the supreme self. It's the self of all. So we need to be cognizant of that unity at all times, that this self, this Christ principle in my own heart, this ray of individuality comes from a root. And I think Laura, the previous speaker, connected that to the sun, remembering that behind that physical sun, there is that spiritual central sun from which we come. And when we get ready, we return to it. And the meditative process is just for that, for the realization of that self and that connectivity of all of the cells, which is designated in the beginning of the sacred doctrine with a circle with a point in its center, which suggests manifestation, remembering that it also exists prior to it, but the point points to the manifestation. One other thing wanted to discuss was the associative part of memory. This is what comes up as soon as we sit for meditation or concentration. And we put that highest ideal in front of us, but as soon as we want to concentrate on that, a flush of recollections of all sorts of affairs, all thoughts, impressions come before the mind, driving that higher ideal away from us. And then concentration is truly at an end. What does Mr. Just suggest? He says, in order to become successful in that concentration process, no strange formula is necessary, but just that we practice it, that we have diligence and perseverance, and that we continue with that process until in time that lower mind becomes quiet. And that is that the higher mind is coming to our aid, but as we know, it is not of this earthly plane, so it needs to be invited in. And as we continue this process, that is exactly what we are doing. And in this process, the will which is a spiritual quality of the mind. It is not the mind, but it is the quality, the spiritual quality of the soul. Remembering that the mind is the tool of the soul and the brain is the tool of the mind. So in this sequential order, then we overcome our difficulties and we act in accordance with that desire that enables us to do this. It is Mr. Judge's statement before I finish this process. It says, if we do all our acts, small and great, every moment for the sake of the whole human race, as representing that supreme self, then every cell and fiber of the body and the inner man will be turned in one direction, resulting in perfect concentration. And then he says, let us meditate on that which is in us as the highest self. Concentrate upon it and will to work for it as dwelling in every human heart. Now we'll take your questions.
Yes, Michael.
Excluding the mundane or the worldly aspect of life, we see that we are asked to include the entire universe in our in the fact that we should consider space. And that we are the center of space, and that as we consider this, that we should expand our heart to include everything in space and just keep on moving it from where we are and constantly expanding it outward. This abstract kind of meditation, is this helpful?
Is the abstract meditation helpful? Because the recommendation is that we not concentrate on the lower aspects of us. But remember, we are not the lower aspects at all. Those are our vehicles. That's not who we are. We are just using them. So in order to realize that inner light, we do have to become universal in the sense that we perceive the unity of all life to constitute one life. So Mr. Judge's suggestion in that regard is very useful. He says, as you are sitting in your meditation corner, wherever that might be, or in your daily concentration as to what your heart's desire to bring it about, is to put yourself as a spot in the center of your circle. I don't have a board, and try to spiral it from that core outside of it. In other words, the circle becomes larger and larger. You are where? In your home. So your family is part of that conglomeration, constitutes your immediate environment. And from there, it's suggested that you go to your community. So you're involving all of the souls in your community. And from there, you're going to your state. And from there, you're going to your country. And from there, you're going to become a world citizen and expand it to all of the other countries, remembering that each country representing a human family, that we are all part of that one supreme soul. All of the countries, in other words, the human beings in those countries constituting one family, we are truly one. When you unite that in your own mind, it will open you to other spheres besides the three-dimensional space we occupy. Laura has her hand.
Yes. You mentioned the obstacle of the associative power part of our memory, and how when we sit down for meditation, that it floods us with images that carry us off. And I was wondering, is there something that we need to do during the day leading up to that meditation that would help us in regards to that associative part of the memory?
Well, the associative part of the memory in the older writings is referred to as fantasy. In other words, it has no reality. Excuse me. What we are trying to do in this meditative process, or the concentration aspect of that meditative process, is to put the highest ideal. And when your mind veers away from that, you have to bring it back and put it on that which you want to concentrate at. Now, in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, even though that's not my talk, on the first page in Mr. Judge's transliteration, he says that the lower mind has a tendency to diffuseness. In other words, it goes from one subject to the, it's like the monkey mind we were talking about. It jumps. It goes from one subject to the next subject, to one object to the next object. So that is what we are trying to control. So what did Mr. Judge say? Continuance with the process. In other words, wherever it goes, you bring it back and put it on the ideal that you wish to concentrate on. In time, it will quieten down. But at first, it will not. It takes a long time to actually put it into order. But if you persevere, if you're diligent, and as you said, your aim is to be able to help others, and knowledge is necessary. Mr. Judd says that power in the future ages is going to be a necessary part of this process, that without power, we won't be able to help others as we want to help them. In other words, if it is based on the higher ideal, the world of ideals is the world of thought. If it is based on that and you bring it down, it has in it the suggestion as to how to deal with the problem that has been presented to you, where your help is necessary. In other words, we are not judging anything. That world is non-judgmental. It accepts, it gives love, it is blissful. And this is what your world needs to become, so that we can intelligently, with knowledge, help all those around us. Because it's said that philanthropy is a necessary part of this process. And you said, when I'm helping someone, that is the only time that monkey mind is quiet. So in your mind, you have to put those things in your meditation process. What was Mr. Judge's suggestion? Let me go back to it. He said to know discriminately what to do and what not to do. Because that process of elimination, because we are bombarded with a lot of things that we come to be asked to do, but we cannot do all of it. It's not possible. So that's the first process. He says, when you start doing this discrimination as to what is that I need to do, what is it that I ought to do, this process helps you greatly in that process. The other one was the philanthropic route that is definitely in most of our lifestyles. We all want to help others.
Eva, you had a question? Eva?
Yes, I do, actually. I was wondering what part humor has in the process of meditation.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
I was asking what part humor has or plays in the process of meditation.
What humor has?
Humor,
humor. Humor. Okay, humor is the soul's way of dealing with joy, humor. And there is an article, I don't know who wrote it, whether it is Mr. Judges or not, that through that process, we can actually learn the true value of ourselves. In other words, we see ourselves as we are rather than what we think we are. So it does have a benefit in that department. It enables us to see clearly as to who we are. And remember, those people who use humor are very intelligent, but only that they're cheerful. And Mr. Judge's suggestion is also that if you have gotten out of bed on the wrong side of the bed, don't go and distribute that misery to other people, but use humor and cheerfulness, even if it is a kind word that you're expressing to the other person, it makes a tremendous difference in their lives.
Judy, you had your hand up? Judy?
Yes, I did. The thought came to mind that as we move through the duties of our regular day, that if we avoid multitasking, if we practice from moment to moment, staying focused, staying in the now, doing one thing at a time and doing it to the best we can under the conditions, are we setting up certain tendencies that can then assist with divesting ourselves of that monkey mind when we're trying to sit for a period of devotional meditation?
Well, first of all, remembering that what we do on earth is a reflection of the other part of us that we live at night. Yes, it does make a difference because the habits that we cultivate are actually what our character is made up of. So if we are taking things one step at a time, and behind that one step at a time process that you just described, remembering, suppose you're cooking. Are you cooking with joy and love and remembering that the whole family is going to participate in that? In other words, unity comes into it, does it not? And if you're cleaning, they always recommend that our room where we meditate be clean and that it be aired. They don't make a lot of recommendations, but that is definitely one of them. So if you're cleaning your home and that is your attention, what are you elevating? All of the elementals, are we not? And when we talk, for instance, are we cheerful or are we argumentative? That also has a tremendous building capacity of our character. It becomes quieter. It becomes concerned with the welfare of others. Here again, we are composing it on unity. So yes, all those things do affect our character, remembering that what we do every day actually becomes ingrained in it. So yes, it does make a tremendous difference in building a character. Remembering that in each life, our purpose is to come back as a higher individuality, meaning that we have overcome some of the difficulties that we brought with us into this life, we have overcome them. So in the next life, when we come back, we will be a higher individuality, hopefully, and we will have a greater impact in helping and assisting others and also disseminating the true philosophy as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have a question. Sign is Moto, E6. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Mike, I'm going to ask, since we have to make these efforts to, again, I'm maybe using the wrong word, efforts to cultivate this higher sense of connection with divinity and of kindliness and of brotherhood, are we basically flawed individuals? since we have to make these efforts.
Are we flawed as individuals?
Yes.
Remembering that there is the personality aspect, which is the monkey mind or the intellectual mind in conjunction with our passions and desires and all the skandhas that we have brought from the previous life. That's our earthly life, without which we cannot live on earth. In other words, we need a physical body, we need a brain, because all our five senses are necessary in our developmental stages. We are gathering information from the environment, from our universe. But that's not who I am. I refuse to identify as being that. This is what the difference is. When you sit into meditation, you are bringing forth that you are that thou art, that you are the individuality, that you are that light, that you are that Christ principle in your heart, and that you are identifying yourself with it. Because the meditative process is there to actually enable us to eventually become one with the all, and understanding that we're not separate from anything or anyone, that we are part of that supreme self, then you understand, as the previous speaker said, that you don't have any defects. The defects are all in the lower quaternary, not the higher triad. In soul and spirit, we're all perfect. It's just we need to get the personality quietened so that the higher can actually shine through the physical, enabling us to do greater scope of work.
Thank you very much. We'll now move to our next section on the pitfalls and obstructions to meditation, this section being presented by a student, an associate of the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. When we were thinking about this subject and how prevalent and popular meditation is these days, it struck us that you don't get to hear too much about the pitfalls and obstacles to meditation, unless, of course, you're a student of theosophy and familiar with those teachings. And that seemed kind of odd, because the Native American Indians and the professional trackers who are their students, the primary skill that you have to learn before going out in the wilderness or getting familiar in an environment is to understand the pitfalls and the obstacles. Because if you don't do that, you're not going to survive. And it's really going to get in the way of your progress. And in a way, meditation is a venturing into new environment within, a new journey. And it's important that we understand the pitfalls and obstacles. So for the purpose of this presentation, we'll define a pitfall as a hidden or unexpected danger to meditation. And so let's start out with a general principle. Any remedy or practice, physical or mental, while generally beneficial, has the potential for causing harm if misused or abused. In the case of the mental practice of meditation, the harm here is caused by the misuse or abuse of the faculties and powers of mind. The pitfalls to meditation are real, hidden, and unexpected, because they may incur in spite of the motive and intention of the practitioner, and because the harm caused may be delayed or develop subtly over a period of time and be obscured by the more apparent benefits and relief of meditation. Now, the methods and principles of meditation that we've talked about today are not only beneficial and safe use of the mental faculties, but they are calculated to help the practitioner avoid the hidden and unsuspected dangers of some meditation practices. Now, the most common pitfall to meditation is the increase in mental passivity. So let's start with a universal idea. Every aspect of human nature is subject to the universal law of periodicity as manifested by times of activity and rest. And the mind is no exception. There is a natural activity or motion of the mind, and there is a natural rest, inactivity, or passivity of the mind. The practice of concentration or one-pointedness, as we have heard, will curb the natural motion of the mind and avoid the increased risk of mental passivity. Now, there is a natural passivity of the mind, as we said, and it might be unproductive, but it is not necessarily harmful unless excessive. And examples of the natural passivity of the mind could be seen in indifference, in daydreaming, in inattentiveness, and sleeping. However, certain meditation practices significantly increase the passivity of the mind and have a decidedly harmful effect on the practitioner. And the regular and persistent continuance of these practices sooner or later results in an increased susceptibility to suggestion, increased vulnerability to the influence of other beings, increased sensitivity to internal sensations and impressions, and an inability to conduct oneself appropriately or control impulses. And this ultimately, as we can see, results in a tendency towards physical and mental illness. While these practices may temporarily bring relief from the stress of the nagging thoughts, feelings, and memories, they weaken, and here's the point, they weaken the lower mind's natural activity to serve as a bridge to the influence of the higher mind. Because there's actually one mind with two aspects, and so an important part of the lower is to be a bridge, and it has to be active for those influences to come through. So what are some of the practices that increase mental passivity? And we're going to look at just a few, perhaps in the question and answer time or in the later next presentation, we'll go into it deeper. But there's a whole class of practices which allow the mind to consider nothing or to dwell on nothing. That's not the natural state of the thinker or the mind, because as we said, its natural faculty is thought. So to forcibly allow the mind to consider nothing increases its passivity or inactivity. So forcibly staring at a spot on the wall was mentioned. The meaningless and formulaic repetition or muttering of a mantra, word or phrase without any effort to understand its value or meaning is conductive of an inactivity of the mind. Any practice that suspends the use of the mind's free will, choice, discrimination also leads to its passivity. So opening the mind up, indiscriminately letting whatever thought and feeling or impression wants to come into the mind without any effort to discern or eliminate it, creates a passivity. Forcing the mind to remain blank by not letting any thought, feeling, or impression come into the mind is also a passivity. So we see the excesses, letting too much come in and not letting anything come in. There has to be a balance. The middle of the road, so to speak. So now we'll move briefly to the obstacles to meditation. And obstacles are different than pitfalls. For the purposes of this presentation, we're going to define an obstacle as anything that blocks one's way or prevents or hinders progress in meditation. So it's not necessarily an hidden or unsuspected danger, but it does block and hinder progress. Now, all human progress depends, it's a general principle, depends on self-induced and self-devised effort. But this effort and this progress may be blocked by the karmic effect of reactions of previous, of one's own previous actions or the actions of another. So the obstructive or blocking aspects of karma can be experienced by the practitioner in three fields: the physical, the mental, and the psychic or feeling nature. For each one of these obstacles, there is a path given in the devotional books and other books to help us get around or go through the obstacle. Now, the obstacles themselves are not entirely negative or hindering, because as they come up, they are also definite indicators where the practitioner needs to do more work to improve one's nature. And that is one of the goals and purposes of meditation. So the presence of these obstacles is not to be fretted about or worried about. It's an opportunity to learn, and yet we cannot let it prevent our progress. So there are three types of obstacles that we're going to focus on briefly. One are the obstacles in the physical body and the physical circumstances. Now, of course, one obstacle comes up from the duties and distractions of everyday life and our environment. This was touched on before. But we can, if we want to set up a time for meditation, we can get around that by finding for ourselves a private place, a quiet place. And if we can't, go within our mind to that private center of awareness, that quiet center of awareness within. So when might be the best times to meditate? When there might be the least distraction from our duties and our environment? Well, certainly upon arising or before going to bed. But besides being a useful way to avoid the obstacles of our daily lives, meditation, when we first get up, sets a good keynote, a good tone for purpose and intention for the day. And meditation at the end of the day, before we go to bed, helps us learn, discern the lessons of the day, and also prepares our mind and our nature for going into the sleep condition. So we're told that we might want to take advantage of the cyclic law of return of impression, because we know some people have just a question, like any kind of exercise, of getting into the habit of doing it and bringing all our mental and powers to focus at one time. And if we can recall Mr. Judge's advice and teaching on the return of impressions, if we can do it approximately the same time every day, we train ourselves. Just like if we eat at the same time every day, sure enough, at that time, we start to get the hunger pains, and our body tells us it's expecting something. We condition the lives of our physical nature. And we can condition and train faculties as well to respond at a peak if we do things around the same time. And then the other physical obstacles have to do with the weakness and ailments of the body. Now, aside from illness and disease, having good posture, gentle breathing in and out certainly is relaxing. Moderation and exertion and diet. It's hard to meditate if one is completely exhausted or overextended. It takes a long time to get into meditation. And certainly if one overeats, that can be an obstacle as well, especially if one does it prior to meditation. So these general principles will help us deal with the physical obstacles. When it comes to the obstacles that relate to our personal, psychic, and feeling emotional nature, we might use as a guide what Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita about the three qualities of nature, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And here, the soul is bound and is bound down and influenced by attachment to the qualities. And we can see these attachments to the qualities operating in the obstacles that come up in our inner nature. For example, the thinker is distracted from the purposes of meditation by personal attachment to that which is pleasant or peaceful. We might call that the sattvic, attachment to the sattvic quality. So in our periods of meditation, pleasant memories come up, experiences of the day come up, a sense of peacefulness comes up, satisfaction with the way things are going comes up. And we're so attached to that that we really don't, we find ourselves getting caught in the groove of dwelling on that and really don't make the effort to dig and explore and look further into what we might do in a useful way during the meditation. We get too attached to the peacefulness of it or the pleasantness of it. Because meditation, as Krishna tells us, is an active time. It requires some effort. The thinker is also distracted from the purposes of meditation by personal attachment to pleasant and unpleasant experiences, likes and dislikes, emotional experiences connected with memories of daily existence, the desire for personal reward. So here's, we find ourselves, a memory comes up, and we just can't let go of it. Yeah, we're so much hurt by it or pleased by it that we get bound down in the pleasantness and the unpleasantness of it, and it becomes an obstacle for the use of the mind in the right direction. And then the thinker is distracted from the purposes of meditation by attachment what we'll call the tamasic quality, heedlessness, laziness, lack of desire, carelessness. So we may begin our meditation, but then fall asleep, drift off, make the best use of it. And this is our period of meditation that might be influenced by the tamasic quality. So Krishna tells us that when these times come, when these attachments come, because they will until we learn to free ourselves from them, not to be upset by them, not to be elated by them, but learn from them. We're learning here about ourselves. And even if we find ourselves attached, that's an opportunity for self-study and examination, a valuable purpose of meditation. So we learn from what is not true, much as we do learning what is true. We learn from what not to do as much as we learn from what to do. And it's the same with meditation. We can learn from these obstacles. And finally, we'll finish up with the obstacles of mental nature. Some of these have been mentioned, and we're going to go into them in more depth in the next presentation. And these have very much to do with what Patanjali tells us, that the modifications of the thinking principle. And this has to do with the nature of the lower mind. Besides the mind moving around from one, in its own tendency, we call it the monkey mind. It moves from one thing to another, like a monkey through the forest. Aside from that, it jumps to pleasant and unpleasant memories. But it also, potentially tells us, has this quality of identifying with and becoming confined by that which it dwells upon. It's like liquid being poured into a container. It takes the shape of the limitations of the container it's put in. So because of our mind, that it itself can be an obstacle if we dwell too much or identify with these personal conditions. So all these are obstacles, a number of others. Some of them have been touched upon, and our next speaker will continue along this line. So we just wanted to stop here and invite you, if you have any particular questions or comments you'd like to bring forth about what you've observed as obstacles and pitfalls to meditation.
Move your hand. That's why I wanted to leave it on.
Okay. Yes.
Sometimes you're able to transcend to the higher fields of operation, and the next second you find yourself right here on Earth. What kind of obstacle would be in your way in your dropping so fast to where you're sitting from that higher state of mind where you were?
Yes. Well, we think this is where knowledge of the natural tendencies of the mind, and this there is a natural focus of the mind, which we have, which may come in with various strengths, but the mind itself has tendencies to move about from one thing to another. If left on its own, it will jump around. So we may, with effort and will and focus, place it on the higher, place it on someone we care about, place it on a desire to help others. And as was reported by other students, that helps quiet the mind. But as soon as that's released, we find the mind going back to its natural tendency to drift to other things. So we're told that eventually we learn through this practice of meditation to control this instrument of the mind that we need very much, but we need to be able to direct it. So it's the natural motion of the mind, uncontrolled, unchecked by the will and focus of the meditator, that allows for that to occur. Yes, Michael?
You mentioned that finding that having a special place to meditate in your home or whatever. Sometimes it's said, we've heard that incense, that smell will take you to that place, or a sound. And you did mention mantras. We are told that these are helpful, but are these a hindrance as well?
Or sounds? A hindrance?
Well, are relying on sounds?
Well, we would say there are aids, that the proper use of certain things can be aids, but like any aid, they're meant to be temporary. They're meant to be training vehicle. And so we have all the capacities within our own nature to use that. But certainly a pleasant environment that's relatively free of noise and sound distraction, that is not tainted by unpleasant odors, will be helpful. As far as mantras are concerned, well, it depends what we mean, how we're using a mantra. It might be helpful, for example, for us to read or even say out loud, either before a period of meditation or before we go to sleep or even before preparing for a class, something that we've read from a devotional book. And very often these devotional books were meant to be spoken out loud or sung out loud, especially the Bhagavad Gita. And the very repetition of the words has a quality which has a beneficial effect on the mind, mantramic effect on the mind. But once again, if we just repeat things like muttering, where we either don't understand it or we don't make any effort to understand it, the practice is really not as helpful as it could be. Is there a hand that went up?
Laura's hand went up, Steve.
Laura? Okay. Oh, there you are.
Yes. I'm just wondering about what it says in the Voice of the Silence in regards to these pitfalls and obstructions. We seem to conquer a few of the pitfalls and the obstructions, and then we're told, beware of change.
Mm.
It can throw us off. Until we go through that, we're not aware of it. It's like getting hit on the side of the head when you don't see a bus coming or something. You know, it throws us off. So how do we overcome, and what is the nature of this idea of being aware of change? Mm-hmm. Beware of change.
Well, we might address that interesting question just in the context of meditation, because as you pointed out, any abrupt change to our routine will temporarily throw us off. And that's not a bad thing. That's just what we need to get out of our ruts and begin to try things new. Certainly we've all gone through a big change in the last few months, and some of the results have been very productive of new ways of doing things. And for others, it's thrown them off quite a bit. So the change that we want to be aware of is dwelling too much or getting too concerned about the changeable aspects of our nature. The value of meditation, the foundation of meditation, the focus of meditation, everything we've said so far is to help us realize that there's that in us which is changeless. And it's the source of our light and our wisdom, our inspiration, our spiritual guidance. And the more we can direct the mind to that, the more the mind identifies, the more mind becomes like that and a better vehicle for the expression of that wisdom, the more productive our meditation will be. But on the other hand, we cannot avoid that there is change involved in our lives. Everything in our nature that we use as an instrument changes. Everything we experience in nature changes. So while we become aware of it, while we learn from it, while we learn more about ourselves from it, we cannot identify with it and forget of who and what we are as spiritual beings. We are spiritual beings working through changing conditions. We are not those changing conditions. And that's what we need to be aware of.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'd like to start here and invite our final presenter, who will give a short talk on an introduction to Raja Yoga, and hopefully be able to tie together some of the themes we've talked about today. Our presenter is a student and associate of the United Lodge of Theosophists in New York.
Hey, thank you, Steve, and thank everyone for sharing your thoughts and ideas concerning this topic. Let me say that this portion will deal primarily with Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. Why? Simply because every time yoga or wisdom is mentioned by Mr. Judge, that's where he refers the questioner. And so we can think of Raja Yoga as being that royal or kingly wisdom that embraces the entire spectrum of evolutionary development that can possibly occur in this round of our existence. It results in a self-reflective and conscious awareness, as well as identity with that divine soul that is typically referred to in many different ways as the watcher or the perceiver. When we talk about Patanjali's, we have to realize that it is multi-layered. It deals with multiple ideas, and it in fact embraces the entire secret doctrine and what was not even mentioned in the secret doctrine, if we are pursuing it as a lifelong study and practice. To give the end result, we can say that the first four aphorisms reflect the entire 153 or 54 aphorisms in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms. The first deals with the fact that yoga is to be taught, and there is the word assuredly, implying that there is nothing else. The second deals with the idea that it is the hindering of the modifications of the mind, which include all conceptualization from correct cognition to incorrect cognition to fancy, as was mentioned, to dreams in every aspect of their being, even into the deep sleep state and beyond, and to memory as it relates to the memory of the soul. The third aphorism I will read, and it says, at the time of concentration, the soul abides in the state of a spectator without a spectacle. That is the end result and the totality of the experience of what meditation can lead to as a tool. At other times than that of concentration, the soul is in the same form as the modification of the mind, which pertains to everything that exists under the banner of Prakriti and the gunas, as we are experiencing it from the point of view of Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. This is an experiential science. It is a spiritual science that has to do with, again, a full awareness and awakening of what we are perceiving. This is a modified quote that I will read from one of the teachers concerning this same idea. The divine spiritual soul, known as the lordly self-existent divine self, is that power which is perceived by self. It is the Atman or seventh principle, ridded of all of its mayavic distinctions. No maya, no prakriti, no ignorance. From its universal source. It is this which becomes the object at one stage of perception for and by the individuality once they are centered in the principle of Buddha. That in and of itself is an encyclopedia of knowledge and instruction. Once we go into book one of Patanjali, he clearly leads us through what the modifications of mind are and how we have to deal with them. And we deal with them through exercise and dispassion continuously applied at every level of cosmos that we encounter as we are making our way consciously from gross physical matter to the highest level of Prakriti. In Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, there are those true yogis that understand each of these planes and consummate each of these planes and master each of these planes, just as they master the principles within their own being. Once true exercise and dispassion is used, there are stages of meditational accomplishment that judge in Patanjali's and Patanjali himself refers to. They are four, superficially a number. Judge identifies six. They are called the argumentative, the non-argumentative, the deliberative, the non-deliberative, the beatific, and the egoic. And anyone that has done a systematic study of meditations worldwide will recognize that every system of meditation that has been evoked, from the tantras and the Buddhist tantras to the Advaita systems, to Patanjali systems, to Yogacharya, as Madame Blavatsky tells us in Secret Doctrine, all embrace these lower aspects of meditational accomplishment. Judge tells us in Patanjali that they have to do with the physical level when we're talking about the argumentative, and this is where deep contemplation comes in because it is the scientific investigation mentally of every aspect, cause and effect, retribution, essence, nature, properties, aggregates, and manifestational forms that these elements take on. That is step one. It is not the end. Step two takes us to the astral plane, if we use theosophical terminology, and that has to do with the inner subtle. And there is an outside to that and an inside, which is why he says the deliberative and the non-deliberative. And then he speaks of the beatific, which has to do with the higher mind. And if we really understand HPB's application of the higher mind in her renditions of dreams and visions, there are several aspects even of this. And once we leave that plane, we are now entering into the domain of manas. And in that domain, we have to overcome the eye-making faculty, which is called specifically ahamkara, and creates the idea of separateness and illusion that we cling to, which confuses and just causes many of the pitfalls and obscurations that Steve was referring to. And from that perspective, we move on to another level. All of these are explained in 5 Years of Theosophy in Madame Blavatsky's article related to the Sevenfold Constitution, as she and Subodh have gone back and forth with their discussions regarding the Tibetan mode of understanding and the Advaita mode of understanding. The text goes on in Patanjali to talk about abstract meditation, and abstract meditation takes us directly to our goal. But if we are unclear about that, we can work on abstract meditation from the perspective of the Ishvaric principle of our nature, that state of consciousness that it embraces, that is related to the Brahmanic state, or the synthetic aggregate of all of the Dhyan Chohans, if we use that terminology, that have to do with the wisdom and the knowledge concerning the unfolding of the universe. If that is a little bit too tough, we can deal with the word Om in all of its significance. As the previous speaker said, it's not simply a matter of talking and mantric repetition, it's repetition with reflection, with imagery, with understanding, and with search. And that is the contemplative aspect, again, still of the lower levels of meditational approach. Once we move on through that, it is said that these types then they actually get rid of the obscurations that are involved in meditation. Some of those you've heard, whether they're pitfalls, whether they're overt, whether they're covert, but they have to do with sickness, they have to do with laziness, with mental torpor, with doubt, with addiction to any level of sensory, phenomenal perception, subtle, very subtle, or even subtly causal, that has to do with the samskaras and the skandhas, i.e. the karmic elements that make us take on the forms that we use. So all of those are obstacles to achieving that, plus the inability to achieve any level of abstract meditation, in addition to the failure to achieve stability in those particular states. And so all of those things are identified as the obstacles. In order to move beyond those obstacles, the teachings of Patanjali tell us that we can engage in the practice of steadiness of mind. And all of these things have been mentioned in the previous talks, but Patanjali is putting them to everyday, minute-to-minute practice. And that steadiness of mind is, again, the ability to put mind on a particular topic, every activity that we are engaged in order to master that steadiness. Eventually, when that occurs, we are able to maintain our mind independent of idiosyncratic things of desire or avoidance on that particular object to such an extent that oneness, as was mentioned with it, does occur. And as a result of that continued practice, along with purification, not to mention service to all of humanity, we gain an understanding of the inner levels of all phenomena. That was again mentioned in the very beginning in regards to the 4/6 stages of insightful meditation that occur, that are unfolding the very structures of phenomenal manifestation to the mind of the yogi that is in practice and in learning for the benefit of humanity. Once we are able to move past that, we can then, in terms of what Patanjali talks about, better understand the content that we encounter during those planes of existence or states of meditational pursuit. Book 2 deals primarily with the means whereby all of this can be speedily achieved. Those means have to do with minimizing the afflictions. Those afflictions have been identified clearly as ignorance in every aspect, as egoism, which is the I making sense that we identify with, that we misidentify with, that then subsequently hinders everything that we do. Desire in any of its aspects, avoidance, which is the desire to avoid something that we don't like, and clinging and fear, as it has to do with death or any change or transition that relates to any particular plane of existence. This is what Patanjali is putting forth before us. Once we have dealt with those afflictions, usually by purification of mind, as he says, by meaningful muttering, by the mortification of the body, which is not just beating oneself, but a systematic modality of training the instrument that we are using, we can then move on to understanding that it is what is called the conjoining of the soul with nature through the organ of mind or lower consciousness that is the cause of these afflictions. And these afflictions are subsequently the cause of all karma. We cannot read Patanjali without realizing that half of it is related to karma. And Judge's renditions of karma, the aphorisms, can all be found in Patanjali in terms of how they operate and why. We can then move on to recognizing, according to Patanjali, that the sevenfold perfect discriminative distinction is what needs to be encountered, understood, and achieved if we are to move on to the goal. And that sevenfold method is related to the 8 limbs of yoga. Those 8 limbs of yoga have been mentioned superficially and require a lot of study, but they do have to do with the first 10, morality. It has to do with social correctness. The first 5 are not killing, not stealing, not lying. They have to do with continence, and they have to do with non-coveting. These are all social factors of interacting with human beings and life. The second 5 have to do with what we should not be doing. What we should be doing in terms of the purification of mind and body and soul, in terms of remaining clear in regards to our mind, the muttering that was mentioned appropriately of an inaudible type, which has to do more with mind cleansing than verbal pronunciation, and the, again, resignation and total discrimination of the goals that we have in mind. These typically result in the end product, and we have to kind of rush this along, that is at the end of book 2, the perfect subjugation of the senses, which has to do with the idea of pratyahara. It is the turtle symbolically that is able to withdraw all of its senses into the knot of the heart or whatever other center is being considered in order to obtain knowledge. Madame Blavatsky then talks about dharana, which brings us to book 3, which has to do with attention, contemplation, and meditation, which when really enhanced and perfected gradually results in samyana. She says the dharana practice, which begins after the subjugation of the senses, is really that about the soul leaving the body. And this is the so-called second birth and has to do with the partially liberated consciousness that no longer is bent on believing itself to be a body. Book three then goes on to talk about the steps that are encountered, the training that is encountered. It mentions everything from the elementals to the elements, to the kingdoms, to the chakras in the body, to the centers behind those, to the consciousness, to the mind, and how that once again is conjoined with the body and how that inner self can be liberated. It deals with the hierarchies of spiritual existence and much more. Why? Because that is the chapter of teaching, training, and purification in regards to a full knowledge of what we are not. Book four is a wonderful book in itself because, again, like book three and book two, deals a lot with karma, but it talks about karma from the higher perspective of the, again, we have to look this word up in the glossary, samskaras, because these are the imprints, the vasanas, the powerful forces that are lodged in the mind that Judge calls the mental deposits that dictate karmic unfolding. Chapter four or book four deals with the soul's ability to work itself so well, to purify itself so well, to keep its eye on the only target that it can rise to a level where these become obvious. And so at that time, all of the knowledge that's affiliated with that, all of this knowledge is related to as meditation with seed. We are then able to move beyond to understand the nature of the gunas. In understanding the nature of the gunas, we begin to understand the nature of time. We begin to understand the nature of succession, which is how karma unfolds in a world of law. And then Patanjali tells us that if we still have that utter dispassion towards identifying or desiring or avoiding or hating any of this knowledge that we are now encountering, we enter upon that stage where we embrace what is called Dharma Megha, identified as the cloud of virtue. It is the totality of knowledge, and it is the, how can I say, formal side of what was referred to in the first talk about Krishna and Arjuna when he was shown the divine form. For the adept yogi, that would be a theosophical adept or Mahatma, this is a study in concentration due to the power of concentrating on the information that is revealed and the laws that move that information. And then Patanjali says, if we are dispassionate towards this, the gunas are reabsorbed in the nature of prakriti. Prakriti then becomes dormant and translucent and ultimately reflective of that first state that we mentioned in reading what came from Blavatsky's teachers, the lordly self, self-existent power, the divine self perceived by the self of the yogi. And once that is done, there is no nirvana, there is no rest, there is only the decision to refuse that state as a permanent state for the remaining part of our cyclic existence, to serve life and humanity. So that's a short synopsis of Patanjali's aphorisms as it relates to Raja Yoga and the path of awakening.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? We recall that there's a caution with studying Patanjali's yoga aphorisms that like many of the devotional books, it's symbolic and requires a degree of extra understanding or knowledge to decipher the meaning there. And we think, as much as we study the aphorisms, we also have to focus on Judge's commentaries, because he gives us the theosophical or the underlying principles involved. Otherwise, we might be misled if we just go by the outer expression of that book.
Clearly, we have to be careful. The outer expression doesn't really do anything. It is only a vow, a lifelong commitment, and really, as I think in some of the writers, the Elixir of Life was mentioned. Damodar wrote on the Elixir of Life and the fact that individuals choose portions of this to practice. And what Patanjali does is lays out a complete system, and in that system, every step is necessary. There are the social values, there are the moral values, there are the mental disciplines, there are the mental purifications, there are the practices, there's a recognition of the different planes, there's a recognition of the different principles, and it is a roadmap to ourselves. And if we follow that, as the teachings have said, even that which is within us helps us along that way.
I would like to say something.
Yes.
We thank Jean tremendously, but that brief statement, according to him, would take me a couple years to understand, let alone retain it, because it is extremely difficult. I sit down with a dictionary just to understand the words. I've been at it a whole year, and I'm going to be at it for many, many more years until I decipher what the inner meaning of those statements are. So if we are the audience, it was extremely difficult to follow you.
And thank you for that comment. I can only reflect on what HBB says when she wrote the SD, in a sense. I mean, this is what it is. I've said nothing that Patanjali has not said. And that's not to say that it's easy. That's not to say that it's hard. That's simply to say that each must approach it in their best way. Each takes the time that they need. Each awakens the knowledge that they need. So there's no right. There's no wrong. It's not a bad thing that it takes 1,000 years. All of us have had many lives, and we come back, as Krishna tells us in the Gita, and at certain portions of our path, if it is genuine, that knowledge reawakens in us, and it is always there to help us. So yes, some will struggle. I think we all struggle. And yes, the words may be alien, but in my mind, and this is specifically only for me, I say, so what? There is nothing else to do. Everything else that we do for others. The only law in my mind for me is the recognition of truth. There is no religion higher than truth. Everything I do during the day is something that can be done, hopefully, to bring joy, light, laughter, and understanding to others, in part because that's my job. And as a shrink or a psychiatrist, as Steve knows, many, many people come with many, many points of view, a lot spiritual, and they have a lot of spiritual questions and answers. And theosophy has been a saving grace for me in that regards, without using the name theosophy. So yes, it's hard, but you know, what else do we have to do?
I just wanted to say, I found it very challenging, but I found it very inspiring, and I was taking notes like crazy, and it was inspiring, and I'm going to go read that through and make my own study of it now. So thank you very much.
It's a very small book, so yes.
good. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I agree. It's killer. Yes, I was taking notes too and looking up words, and it was very, very enlightening.
How do you handle who goes next? Yuri?
Steve, you're... Oh, Steve is muted. You can go, Ray.
Okay. Go ahead, Ray. How do I know? How do I raise my hand without raising my hand? Is there a way on here? I'm somewhat familiar with Zoom. Well, let's do it this way. We're coming up to 4:30. The official part of our presentation is over. We still have another hour of Zoom time available to us. It's basically open mic. You know, we can all have it in a full chat about the principles being brought up. And so go ahead, Ray, you started off.
First of all, I must have gotten instructions wrong. I had the impression that 1 o'clock was when it started. I'm sorry I missed an hour. Has this been videoed by chance?
Recorded by Zoom, so it's preserved on a computer and will be transferred to a podcast and YouTube.
Excellent. Then I may be covering something that has already been covered. But first of all, I would like to just thank Jean. I've waited a long time. It's been either a long time since I've seen you, like maybe 40 or 50 years. And your presentation was goose flesh. Gratitude to it. You covered these four books in a way that maybe in next incarnation I'll be able to read the script on. So having said that, though, I just would like to see what the invitation might be from others in recommending how we can facilitate our meditative practice. I think that is it Tanke?
Tanje?
Tanje, Herb and... anyway, that
you're muted, Herb.
You're muted. She was speaking about the frustration of not being able to hold all this material. And that's been a problem with me for about 45 years. And I really found that my meditation was stuck with me trying to read all the texts that I could get on it. And I have three different versions of Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. I think students of theosophy would approve of all three of them. They all have something to say about it. And I just would like to know if there are other people besides me who have discovered access to this material that will open it up without, let us say, conflicting with the ULT canon. And I mean that in the best of ways and also the most critical. I would say in 5 weeks and certainly in 5 months, and now I'm going on into my first year or so of having found a book which I'm almost hesitant to mention publicly because it's not published by ULT or in our library. And I just wished 40 years ago I just had it pointed out to me. So instead of trying to sell other texts, I've just found in a matter of days and weeks, it happens to be from a theosophist who happened to be in India. It opened up Patanjali in a way that only, I think, HPB and Judge could deeply appreciate, giving the Sanskrit, the Roman translation of the Sanskrit, individualizing each of the terms. Jean, one of the problems that, like someone said, it's impossible to hold all the words and the definitions. And the thing I discovered is that these words have always a contextual meaning. So something that means inhibition in one chapter will mean a two or three different things in another context. And all of them are part of our growth in meditation. So I just wonder if any other people have discovered means of facilitating this.
without my having to be the one that recommends a text that has transformed my meditative practices in weeks. End. Thank you.
I don't want to monopolize this section because the question was asked to everyone, I guess, but so much depends upon where you are, what you're doing, and what you're looking for in terms of the stage that you're at and what becomes helpful at that stage. There are those terms you mentioned, a book with Indian, Sanskrit, etc. They do exist. Judge himself took this as one of the translations from one of the Indian students, I think at Adyar. And so if, as Patanjali says, you begin in the gross argumentative stage with just watching your breath, counting, you know, the moments, reading what you can, that's good enough. There are stages, and in some respects, Judge talks about this in regards to the deliberative stage of meditation. There are no words there. There are no words with meanings. Words with meanings are conventional things. They are, as Patanjali says, based on inference, testimony, and perception. And if that's where we're beginning, that's where we're moving from, that's fine. But there's a point in meditation, as was said, where the object of meditation is lost, and yet not the search. Judge talks about this in Theosophical Articles, I think, when he speaks about the search for knowledge through the astral plane into the deep sleep state, and where the highest virtue and knowledge is sought, because that's the nature of the mind. It's mind, and again, perhaps, you know, my view of things may be a little bit different, but manas differs from mind, and mind differs from the brain. And each of those resonate in different ways to identify with different levels of knowledge. And so if we're using the words, that's fine, but if we can't remember the words, as the teacher said, I think, using that six-pointed symbol, the star, the initiate is, and let's not get hung up on the word initiate, but that individual is able to understand those sevenfold principles and all of, not all, but many of the levels of application that that relates to. And that's not a verbal transmission.
So Jean, I think, is pointing here to two paths. Both are important. Neither can be neglected. And one is, we can spend the next 10 years trying to understand and remember all the words and intellectually understand all the levels. And to a certain degree, we can do that and learn a lot. But we can also spend the next 10 years taking what we do know and practicing it. And from that practice, from within our own nature, will arise the awareness and knowledge, and also opportunity under karma, because these stages are determined by karma, of where we need to go next, what aspect of Patanjali's we need to do next. So even if we're discouraged, we don't understand or can't begin to understand the four chapters, just pick those first four verses in book one, become familiar and practice those, and the rest of it will open up in time.
I think Eva had a comment.
Who?
Eva.
Eva, yes.
Yes, I was wondering, would you say that one of the main purposes for training in meditation would be to reach the witness position in order to be able to move through the different states of consciousness without identifying with the states, but rather being identified with the perceiver? Would that be one of the purposes to do in a 24-hour cycle and in its extension between one life to the next life and so forth?
We can definitely identify with the perceiver as stated. Yes, that would be one approach. People use meditation for different things, as was mentioned in the first talk, just from the physiological point of view and the neurophysiological benefits that it confers. As you imply, when we're talking about attaining the perspective of the witness, yes, we can do that, and should also acknowledge that that should not be a passive witnessing. There is that comment or statement HPB again has in the Secret Doctrine when she speaks about the watcher who sits on the threshold, and he or she or it is able to look into the very heart of that perceptive state of consciousness and yet not go into it. Why? Because they sit in wait for all of the pilgrims that might get lost on their way. And so there's a balancing act, perhaps. Yes, the witness state is an attainment, it's a transcendence, but it's a non-involvement. And all of the Mahatmas, all of the adepts are involved with humanity eternally. And so, yes and yes. But definitely the balancing state and the one that sacrifices the incurrence of more karma for the benefit of the rest of humanity is clearly a hero. I guess that's like the COVID folks that work on the front line. They're the heroes, yes?
Well, I often think with Patanjali's that, as was Steve pointed out, it is the doing of Patanjali's that brings the enlightenment. I find that a lot of times we won't understand what Patanjali's is saying until we've experienced it. Then we'll go back and read it and go, oh, that's what you were trying to say. That is what it's indicated, that we have to go through that experience. And as it says in the voice, nature jealously guards. It won't let you through certain stages. It won't, that, you know, if you have any passion or desire on your feet, you can't go any further into understanding potentially. So you have to, if you get stuck, it's because we have to work on ourselves.
And Laura, thank you. I would bring us back to what you said. We don't pick the flower up to check out where the roots are in terms of whether we're growing. And so my answer is, again, it, you know, in some respects, it doesn't matter. We don't care. We do what we do. We live, we serve, we fight, we move forward, we practice, exercise and dispassion, and we land where we may. It doesn't matter. It's not important. We have a philosophy that we work with. We have embodied that philosophy. We believe that not based on blind faith, but based on the unfolding events of everyday life where we see it in action. And enlightenment doesn't matter. You know, like Nirvana, as the teachers say, that is one of the greatest selfish, most selfish of states. And so we've got no time for that. You know, we give up the devachanic state, we give up whatever those superficial joys are, because the only thing that matters is the elevation of all lives, as Mr. Judge would say, every life. So again, it's not so much that we should even be concerned about how much we know, what we don't know. We practice, we exercise dispassion and trust. One of the aphorisms speaks to the idea of disregard for all objects, and that's everything in phenomena, of happiness, grief, vice, or virtue. And in doing that disregard, along with the paramitas, we simply work. No more, no less. What comes, comes. But when we have a sense of knowing, what comes is not important because it has already been. And as Krishna says, we are simply remembering. You're on mute, Steve. Anything else?
We can take questions on to any of the speakers on any of the subjects brought up today.
Well, is resignation the path?
Is resignation a path?
Again, Lori, you were going to say something.
Well, I think that we have to trust in karma. Karma is compassion itself. It is the law of laws. It is the absolute. And so we don't have to worry about result. We have to renounce it. And we have to do as you suggested earlier, to try and keep on trying and leave the results to karmic law, knowing that whatever we put into the universe, karma is going to give it back to us so that we can learn further. And we don't need to worry about that.
So there's that interesting statement, when the lesson is learned, necessity ceases. Well, that's nature. But how often do we not let go or resign when the lesson's been learned? So all the steps outlined by Jean and others today are periods of learning. But once the lesson is learned with those, they have to be let go. They're not the eternal, they're not the real, they're just stepping stones to higher states and syntheses of learning. We're here to learn, and if we get stuck in any one grade, don't let go of it, we can't progress. Well, saying it very simply, but resignation occurs every step of the way until the final resignation.
How do you raise your hand?
You just did.
Okay. So your finishing comment was in answer to the question of what was resignation. That was, someone asked about what resignation does, but what is resignation in our collective sense, sitting here speaking with one another? Anyone?
Sunjay, I thought you had your hand up, or you were going to say something about that?
About resignation? No, but actually, is there such a thing as resignation is the question. Because when one kind of reviews life from their own perspective, we notice that certain experiences continuously come back. So Dr. Steve just said is very relevant to it, in the sense that if you haven't learned the lesson, it will repeat itself regardless until you do so. It repeats itself. Because there was I can only talk about it from my personal perspective. There was a time in this student's life where things kept coming in the same manner, and I kept saying, well, there must be something written on my forehead for this experience to repeat itself. And then I finally figured out why it came, and then it removed itself. So I don't know if you can really resign, because as Laura said, karma is in charge. And as Dr. Steve said, and you said, it is a learning experience, and that's what we are here to do. So what repeats itself here on this plane is a reflection of the higher one. Remembering that, then we willingly go to it to get the aroma or whatever it is that is being presented to us. I don't think resignation works.
And I would just just add to that again, and Patanjali, yes, can be a little bit daunting, but the study and pursuit and the experience of those aphorisms are invaluable. And in Patanjali, he speaks about the cycle of what we've been calling skandhas that Judge calls the mental deposits and what the Indian terminology calls the samskaras, all different. And yet meditation, as he explains it, done correctly, which is a lifelong process because it goes on even when you're not sitting. If it's only when you're sitting, then it's not meditation. But that process creates what they call in Indian terminology, Sanskrit, samskaras. And those samskaras are the great teachers because they mandate that we have certain experiences. Again, that's in Patanjali. And when we are minimizing, or as Judge says, attenuating and negating them, they negate such experience. They are there as teachers. They are teaching us. Karma is a teacher. It's not beating us up. And when we begin to realize that and work in line with the laws of nature, all of which have been explained definitely throughout theosophy, definitely in many world traditions and religions, but with knowledge and understanding, we literally erase karma. Doesn't mean we get rid of it and don't have to pay it. We erase it. And Judge talks about that in his article pamphlet on karma, where he says, to paraphrase, that karma to the adept is the friend. It is the great helper. I can't, you know, find the words exact.
I hope my comment did not come across as criticism, because it wasn't. We are all grateful for everyone's contributions, including yours, but I just had to bring it to your notice that a lot of us cannot retain the information that you gave out. It's too fast, cannot write it, and it is extremely valuable to have it, but I'm not fast enough to write it. What you said.
I am so sorry. You have to blame that on Steve. He said 15 minutes.
Gene Sharp, you said he was going I was just going to introduce us to the first book, and Gene said he's doing all four books in 15 minutes. the first lesson we need to learn about Patanjali is resign ourselves to the fact that we're not going to know it. This will help clarify it. Are we using the terms resignation and renunciation equivalently, or is there a difference?
Oh, there's a difference.
Between resignation and renunciation.
No, there's a difference, I think.
What is that difference? Maybe that'll help clarify things.
Resignation has given a very clear foundation, if we're using ULT's Patanjali's yoga aphorisms on page 20, the first aphorism speaks of resignation to the Supreme Soul, and there's a commentary on it by Judge that is helpful. And it's one of the most active, if you read just the closing clause of his description of that aphorism, or his commentary on it, it's one of the most active, intense activities that one could imagine being involved in. So obviously it holds a place of importance, of enormous importance, especially since it introduces the entire second book. And the interesting thing about this first aphorism is that it is actually a summary of what is called Kriya Yoga, a whole yoga that is separate in study and with its advocates in school and such. And the definition of how we think about these things is of our language is really important. And that was why I asked, well, how are we going to, you know, how are we going to describe what resignation is? And renunciation, you could do the same thing. The problem is finding a definition that touches your heart and your skin and your body and your mind and your emotions, and these linking these words to not only our vision of excellence and accomplishment and achievement that we would like to have in our lifetime and be able to share and encourage in others, we really, and then connect that with our bodies or our emotions and feelings, is a tough task and really difficult. And I think that that's what's necessary. And frankly, I don't think we get it without this kind of conversation, because it's not in the books. HPB and Judge could not write out what we need to know now, 135, 125, 40 years later. And so, how do we get down to helping one another facilitate these steps in our own practices, our own daily lives, and such? So I'm very interested in what anyone would have to say about clarifying these terms or the resources, a resource that has been a particular help to them besides mining just these books. Our discussions are really important, and I hope to be in on the next one you have on meditation. And especially, Jean, if you happen to be one of the narrators on it.
I think those books are as relevant today as they were then.
The language
might have changed. I do sit with the dictionary quite a bit, but the experience is that those words reveal their inner meaning to you as you go through that process. It's not the words on the page, but what they mean come to you. As Dr. Steve said, the knowledge is internal. You're growing from inside out. It's not that you're putting it in, it's that it's coming out of you, because you already have it stored. All you're doing is bringing it to the surface. That's this student's experience. So sometimes I'm sitting in the meditation room and it's just like something clicks and it becomes really clear. And I can sit there for 3-4 years and I would never know exactly what it means. It's a different experience. What the words mean in their inner meaning is different than what is on that piece of paper, is what I'm getting at. It has a surface meaning, but it also has an inner meaning. And that comes to you because it's internal to yourself, and at the right time, it releases its meaning to you.
So let's start for a really simple distinction between the two, resignation and renunciation. And your idea there that it's an active process is a very good one. But from what we understand of the devotional books, the Voice of the Silence, Bhagavad Gita, we renounce the results of our actions. We renounce the desire for reward. Resignation is renouncing the reality of a condition or state we're in. So Patanjali describes many different levels and states and conditions that we have to learn from. They come as the result of our work, but we have to renounce them, because as we grow and develop in our understanding, there will be other things. So we renounce our identification and our attachment to that condition. Resignation, renunciation is like the one who has the opportunity, through all their effort, to get into nirvana, the final reward, but rejects or renounces the fruit of action. So in one, we're actively renouncing the results of our action, and in the other, we're actively resigning the reality of the condition we're in. It's there, but we don't give it any special significance other than what we can learn from it.
Can I also mention, I guess, Steve and everyone, I mean, in book two, again, the whole teaching is enclosed in pithy ways, as they used to say. So in book one, book two, book three, book four, there's a progression there. there is what we can think of as a simultaneous embodiment of knowledge. And the teachers tell us that's all interpenetrating. The difficulty with the communication in language is that each brain has its own perspective. And so if the brain has not become sufficiently porous, to use Judge's terms, the brain doesn't know the perspective of the use of the word. So even with resignation, as Steve was saying, and with renunciation, from the point of view of the gross, that's one thing. From the point of view of the spiritual, that's another thing. From the point of view of the absolute, we even have to renounce the spiritual. And yet when we are in the world working for others, as Krishna says, it is with moral and ethical fitness as well as knowledge that we serve. And so it's an embracing of all of these levels almost at the same time. Science has done it well in terms of one of the articles, and it was just a picture. And the picture was that in a organ system, there are molecules. In the molecules, there are atoms. In the atoms, there are nuclei. In the nuclei, there are the gluons. In the gluons, there are the hypothetical prions. In the prions, there comes the Higgs particle, which, like Fohat, hardens the atoms and makes them gross. All of that exists here and now, right now. We tune in the radio station to only one. We use only that language, and we expect that that language, when somebody else is talking from channel 3, is the same as channel 1. Doesn't exist. And so unless we are able to create that intense flexibility, that understanding, which is what theosophy does. Theosophy is an enzyme that transforms your entire way of thinking and viewing.
Allows you to absorb it also.
yes, it is. And as Tunjay said, it's what's in. Robert Crosby said that too. And a simple way of looking at that is, if you could understand all of the information in your DNA, what you realize out here is simply what you're tapping into in there. And when you can turn the stations like the scientists do and generate the different alphabets that create the different words, then you're beginning to understand how the gunas themselves work and how all of these things exist here and now. And yet by bias, by training, by misidentification, we choose the comfort zone of this is what's real. And theosophy, if that's what you want, says that's okay. But theosophy also says, if you want something deeper, like the movie, The Matrix, do you want the red pill or the blue pill? We have a choice. And yet, at the end of the story, the path of evolution will take everyone there in time. Some just want to get there so that they can refuse all of the diddly crap to help humanity. And each of us do that in all ways every day to the best of our ability. So hopefully that way we're part of the positive forces in the midst of all of this chaos that's going on around us today.
Well, and help us, because I think that I'm not the only one that is interested. Resignation to the Supreme is very it is integral to the idea of Ishwara, that inner self, the I am instead of it's the I amness instead of I am me, to use an expression that someone else created. And I think that I got stuck on a Christian, let me say, a vernacular interpretation, or a kind of not my will, but thine will be done, to use the Christian inversion of that. And I don't think it actually, and Patanjali, it means that at all. And I think that's picked up also, isn't that same discussion in section 2 on number 32, the sutra number 32, which is religious observances are purified by both mind and body, contentment, austerity, and audible mutterings. Yes, actually it would be, it is that one. And persevering devotion to the Supreme. So it's spoken of there again. And of course, and that means Ishwara, at least I made some correlations there, and the idea of Supreme Spirit. And I just, my feeling is that that's a lot closer than having to wait until I sink into samadhi in my next seven incarnation.
Eva from Sweden has a comment. Eva from Sweden has a comment. Hi, Eva.
Yes, it's getting late here. It's almost 11 o'clock at night. So we would like to thank you all for a very inspiring Zoom meeting. And thank you all
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for staying up so late.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's after midnight. You know. Yeah.
Good night, everyone in Sweden.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Right. You know, it's very helpful. I think what I find I take away from these meetings is a better ability to focus on the study. More clarity comes through, deeper understanding. And I think that what Eugene indicates is going to help me to go back to the Patanjali's and not give up.
If I can just throw something else out, Patanjali works well with the Gita, which works well with the voice of the silence.
Yes.
We all talk about the same
thing. Absolutely.
Use.
Yeah. Well, I got a lot of mud on my feet, so I can't climb the ladder.
You understand Patanjali and Lakamo. Okay.
Okay. Shall we say goodnight?
Yeah, I don't know where Steve went. Steve, you there?
I don't know Steve's where gone. He went, but
he might have had to
went to bed.
I think we should go.
Thank you, Eugene and right. Steve.
Oh, thank everyone.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. It was wonderful.
Bye bye.
Great.
Thank you. Wonderful. Bye bye. See you soon. Do it again. Love you. Bye bye.
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 Bye. Thanks.
Well, seeming we don't have to drive home.
Yeah, that's the best part, isn't it?
Hey, that's a great way of thinking about
that. Then we can get rid of the bad habit of the car.
Yeah,
there right. We go.
Yeah.
And all of our air pollution will go away, right? To a great extent. LA doesn't have it anymore. Getting next time.
Yeah,
that's right.
I guess they don't now. Yeah. Last I heard, they don't.
The sad part of it is I won't get to New York or Philadelphia this year.
No one is traveling this year, Laura.
You've been there for weeks now.
I guess we're all going to have to come up to see you then. You have a big house and a big yard.
You might have to.
Okay. I just want to say that I'm not sure exactly when it's going to click off here, but you can stay on until the connection goes off.
Okay. I can't hear you, Thomas.
Oh.
No, I think I
have
to go.
Yeah, I guess we.
Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
The meeting's.
We couldn't hear you, Tommy.
No.
We can't hear you.
I want to hear your words.
The good thing about this was being together with people
that you don't normally associate with, you know, so all these new ways of seeing things is terrific.
It is very helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very helpful.
Good night, or goodbye.
Good night. Good night, Tom.